Hello and welcome everyone to the first of a two-part podcast series on Tunisia. Today's episode is Tunisia's Amateur Autocrat, The Rise of Kais Saied. This episode delves into the current state of democracy in Tunisia and traces the country's political journey since the Arab Spring. It focuses on the role of civil society groups, the political dynamics at play, and how President Saied rose to power. The episode aims to provide a comprehensive overview of the internal political developments leading up to Saied's consolidation of power. The episode will provide crucial context for part two of our series, Tunisia on the Global Stage and Future Prospects. This podcast is brought to you by the Orfila Center for Global International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the immense support of our partners at the Carnegie Corporation and the Security and Context Network. My name is Omar Mansour, and I am the Public Education Academic Coordinator here at the Orfila Center at UC Santa Barbara. And I'm happy to be joined today by Tariq Al-Majlisi. Tariq, thank you so much for joining us. Would you mind briefly introducing yourself and telling us a bit of how you got into this topic?
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here today, Omar. I'm Tariq Al-Majlisi. I'm a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, where most of my research focuses on North Africa, and most of my work focuses on cohering the European foreign policy towards the region and improving it, for want of a better term. I kind of got involved in this line of work in the aftermath of the Arab Spring and the Libyan Revolution in 2011. I worked briefly with local think tanks, with the first elected authorities in Libya. Since then my path has gone down some strange roads, but I've ended up here now at the ECFR for the past 5 years working on policy issues.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction and for all the work that you do. I think before anything else, it's necessary to talk about the state of Tunisian democracy and governance today in order to put into context exactly what we're going to be talking about here, and then also identify the main character here in our discussion, Kais Saied. So if you could maybe give us, you know, a rundown, what is Tunisia like today under Kais Saied? Who is he? And what is it? Yeah, what is it like to live in Saied's Tunisia?
Let me do it this way, you know, the revolution in Tunis was in 2011, so that's over 10 years ago now. Many of those who are young men today were children at that time, and so they never really knew what it was like to live under dictatorship in that, you know, suffocating way that you only really feel when you're an adult. So today is their first experience of this. The space for free speech, the space for protest is being shut down. And it's happening at a time where the state is failing all around them. Issues such as pollution are skyrocketing. Climate change is causing droughts. Mismanagement of the state and the economy is creating serious shortages of like key things like bread, medicines. And all the time, you know, President Saied is accumulating power in his hands. He's getting more and more authoritarian as time goes on. And so, yeah, the Tunisian people are increasingly nihilistic, increasingly consumed with trying to survive day to day. And President Saied is increasingly kind of in his ivory tower, surrounded by a handful of people who work with him and continuing as is.
So how did we get here? After the revolution, Tunisia was dubbed relatively the only success from the Arab Spring. So how did we get here today?
Yeah, so it's important to qualify the kind of democratic gains that Tunisia made. So Tunisians had a lot more rights after 2011 than they did before. And things like freedom of association and freedom of speech are some of the examples of those that perhaps were taken for granted after 10 years. But, you know, if we look at democracy as a means for the needs and the desires and the aspirations of the public to be represented in political decision-making, Then Tunisia never really finished its democratization. All that happened is that the elite class that was ruling the country grew slightly bigger. So a lot of promises that were made by the elite to the people, such as clamping down on corruption and instituting commissions to investigate abuses in the previous regime's era, stopping police brutality, improving kind of rule of law and justice. None of these things ever happened. And so people started to gradually become more and more disillusioned with the parliament and the system which they had. And the response from everybody to them was that they should be grateful for having this great democracy. And so, yeah, over time, I think people grew stifled by that. And when President Saïd first came into the scene, because, you know, this guy is a constitutional law professor by trade. I say professor. I don't think he even finished his PhD. He's a lecturer. But he's an outsider. So they had this outsider who came in, who was very loud and railing against the system, promising to drain the swamp, which is familiar to you guys in the US. And it kind of worked, right? And other politicians thought that they could ride his wave of populism, and they all got burned by him. And so, yeah, I think the people hoped that they would get this strong, decisive leader who could fix the economy, who could, you know, lead their democratization to the promised land. And what they got was a weak, angry, spiteful dictator instead.
In your pieces, you talk about the disillusionment of the Tunisian citizens and use a phrase, desperation of the masses. These are people that supported Saïd's ascent to the presidency. And among those masses are activist organizations, trade organizations, unions, strong Tunisian institutions that led the way during the revolution. You mentioned that they were also instrumental in Saïd's election.
Yeah, I mean, it was a populational thing in the sense that every different group of society had their own contribution to it. And they had their own reasoning behind it. You had the trade unions and who were concerned that some of the more technocratic or economically liberal and right-wing politicians who were in power would create deals with the IMF that would sap them of all their strength and their relationship with their unions. So they thought that Saïd, being a kind of left-winger, would support them. They were mistaken. He's now attacking them. You had civil society who believed that the parliament had grown to be corrupt and who were working to shut them down. They weren't entirely wrong with that, but this perhaps wasn't the best cure for that problem. And today, President Saïd, or not today, but very recently, President Saïd has put forward a new civil society law, which everybody is now deeply concerned is going to throttle that entire segment of society, which is so vital. Even the political classes, you know, Ennahda, which is the famous Islamic Democrat party that was in power, they supported his presidential campaign because they thought that they could use him to defeat some of their opposition and create this kind of symbiotic relationship with him in the presidency and them leading the parliament, because under the former model, the president was quite weak. It was a parliamentary system, but everybody got burned because I think that there was a group failure to see the bigger picture. And I say that as not being a Tunisian, so perhaps it's easier for me to criticize others. But yeah, I think people's desperations, people's ambitions, a sense of opportunism meant that they all got sucked into a tactical game when the strategic game was always heading in one very bad direction.
You say they got burned. The larger picture wasn't particularly clear. However, these, you know, are experienced politicians or experienced activists, historically very politically involved organizations. Should they have seen this coming?
I mean, it's, you know, as the saying goes, it's 20/20 hindsight, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to be too harsh on them, considering, yeah, this prominent position that Tunisian civil society, and not even civil society, but also political society and political culture has in the broader region. It's much more mature and sophisticated and developed than Libya by comparison. You would have expected that there would be an awareness that a kind of despot and a populist is not a good chisel by which to carve out a democracy. But as I said, you know, I think the situation was kind of desperate.
Yeah.
And the political class and all those who kind of were wrapped up in the idea of Tunisia as an Arab Spring success story were blind to the pain that people were feeling. And the economic pain was hard. And so, yeah, this is where that desperation leads us.
And how did Kais actually, you know, grasp power? I mean, how did he get into this position that he's in today? So he's, you know, he's elected president, but he's a political outsider. Did he have already established institutional networks, any connections? What, you know, what did he do to climb?
Yeah, it's so the kind of catchphrase that people like to use for Saeed now is that he's a weak strong man, because he doesn't actually have a political party or a political base of his own with which to kind of stuff institutions and stuff political offices, which is the traditional way of doing this. And his coup, it wasn't even kind of a traditional armed coup. It's what is kind of technically called an autogolpe, which is a legalese or a constitutional coup. So Saeed became the head of state, the president, through a completely legal way, in a free and fair election. But then he abused his position. He announced a kind of freezing of parliament, and he announced a state of emergency when he had no constitutional authority to do so. He purposefully misread the constitution in kind of such a blatant way that I, who is not a constitutional lawyer, could see that this was a misreading. And in this case, if it wasn't for the army, who supported him by kind of parking their tanks outside of parliament and forcibly preventing a reconvening of parliament, the security services who started to arrest people and put them before military courts, then, you know, this would have just been another crazy rant by Saeed. So it is kind of half him taking this legal route to seizing power, which is what an autogolpe is, and then the security institutions of the state facilitating him to do so.
But these are some of the same institutions that in some ways helped Tunisia become this Arab Spring success story. It's my understanding that the Tunisian army's refusal to fire on protesters in 2011 was a huge factor in the success of the revolution. And now they're aiding in this violation of the constitution.
Yeah, and it's a tricky story, right? I mean, nothing is ever black and white. But the self-perception of the army and the popular perception within Tunisia of their army is that, you know, they are a protector of the state. They are a protector of order. So in 2011, they refused the kind of tyrant's call to fire upon their own people. And in 2020, was it? When there was this kind of, there was an atmosphere of chaos. COVID was running rife. The economy was bad. The political scene was clearly dysfunctional. The army saw this as an opportunity to restore order. And I think armies or military men usually have a particular mindset which is cultivated within them, right? They like clear-cut command and control. They like dictatorships, for want of a better term, because it's a simpler system for them. So I think that the army was always comfortable resorting back to a model where you have a singular strong leader and clear command and control. And they fed into that popular belief that this was a good way forward. But then I think we also have to look at the difference between the army, the Ministry of Defense, which is one thing with one image, and then the Ministry of Interior and the police forces and the gendarmeries in the country, which have a very different relationship with the people. You know, these are the guys who are always in the street beating up protesters. They did it before 2011. They did it after 2011. And one of the big calls from the Tunisian street consistently was to rail these guys in, to kind of create the legal infrastructure that protects people from their police forces, that gives them rights. And the parliament never did it. None of the political parties did it. And perhaps it's an unfair accusation, but I think that because they found comfort in being able to use the police force this way, and they didn't want to challenge them in that way. And then it kind of came back to bite them in the backside because, you know, the army parked their tanks in front of parliament and prevented it from convening, but it was the Ministry of Interior that created this terror that quashes all dissent towards Saeed and is arresting the entire political class right now.
What is Saeed's relationship with the military? Is there at all the possibility of a coup if, according to them, he goes too far or steps out of line?
So Tunisians always say that this won't happen because of what the army did in 2011. I'm a bit more cynical when it comes to armies and when it comes to military men, because they tend to be of a particular type and with a particular vision. But the relationship there is currently a happy relationship. The senior command of the military and of the Ministry of Interior are probably the only people left in the country who can have influence over President Saeed. So the biggest problems they have are within their own ranks and divisions within the institutions that they sit atop of. And I think, again, there's a certain comfort in having this civilian face in front of you who will never curtail you, who always empowers you, but that if worse comes to worst, they can blame for everything. Mm. But I do think that, you know, given the entire political class has been arrested, you know, the problem with tyrants and with dictatorships is that there's never any real political alternative. And Saeed is driving the country into the ground. So there will come a point where his position just becomes untenable, where the economy, the quality of life is so poor that, you know, people are calling for him to be removed, or they just believe that he has to be removed. And at that point, who is going to replace him? I mean, the predecessor, the former tyrant, came in because he pulled this kind of coup on the president before him, whereby he said, oh, you know, the president has become incapacitated, and so I'll just step in temporarily to lead. And he was from the Ministry of Interior. And so perhaps this is what's going to happen eventually.
Could Tunisian institutions in the state that they are now, the damage that they sustained, you know, under Saeed, could they handle a kind of a rough transition like that? Maybe an immediate transition.
I mean, the political institutions of the state have become so gutted under Saeed. You know, Saeed has no political experience or governance experience. So these institutions have just atrophied. And so, yeah, when you have weak and empty institutions anyway, it becomes easier to fill them with supporters and then to regrow them as you want to use them. So, I mean, perhaps Saeed's greatest legacy for Tunisia will be that he destroyed the old constitutional order and he created a new constitutional order that will make it very easy for a more competent authoritarian than he is to take full control of the country.
Do we see this more competent authoritarian leader at all in the public?
Not yet. And I mean, I think a large part of that is because President Saeed is so paranoid about any dissent, about any challenge. You know, even the government under him is incredibly weak. And, you know, anybody who was once trying to create any kind of political alternative is now sitting in jail. So I think people will be wary of taking too prominent a public position.
Mm-hmm. You talked about Saeed running the country into the ground, and now he's gutting the institutions. It doesn't sound like he's making a concerted effort to preserve his own rule, more like he's just enjoying the ride until it ends.
Yeah, you know, the kind of world of diplomats and of everybody trying to engage in Tunisia always feel like Saeed is some kind of guy who's playing chess while they're playing checkers. And the response I always give to this is this guy's not playing chess or checkers. He's in the corner playing solitaire by himself. And I don't think he's entirely cognizant of how bad the situation is because he's so cloistered in his own little circle of yes men. Of security staff who give him very particular briefings only. The fact that you don't really get protests anymore, both because people are scared of protesting, but also because of the nihilism and people don't know what to protest for. And so, you know, all right, despite me saying everything that I've just said, let me give you the other side of the story as well, because this is what's popping into my head. People who know Saeed or who knew Saeed before he became prime president say that this is a completely different guy. He is nothing like the guy that we used to know. And I think that speaks about what power does to people. So you can, I think, give an argument that says that, you know, Saeed is there, he's isolated, there are a lot of problems on his head, and he clearly has no competence or vision to be able to deal with them. So this guy with no clue is trying to fix an entire country, and everything is getting worse. Whichever way you look at it, it doesn't look good.
And speaking to his paranoia and his ability to lead, I think the perfect commentary is, you know, his reaction to tragic and devastating floods in Libya. But his comments about, you know, the name of the storm, implying that, you know, the storm was some sort of Zionist plot.
Yeah, implying, just directly saying that.
This is the man leading, you know, the country.
And this is Saeed, right? I mean, either because he doesn't understand the problems or because he's trying to deflect from the problems. The only thing this guy ever has is conspiracy theories and populism. The problems in the country aren't his fault. They are the fault of kind of shady conspiracists, of economic speculators who are hoarding all the goods. We really don't have any shortages, but these evil guys are just hoarding the goods. Or Europe trying to undermine him. It's always, a populist line. And I think we see the dangerous side of that now as well. Recently, again, there were pogroms. Oh, perhaps it's not the most accurate term to use, but there were mass targeted assaults and violence committed against African communities within Tunisia because his kind of group of choice to pick on were migrants. He kind of latched on to this right-wing great replacement theory and span a Tunisian version of it, saying that Africans are coming, or sub-Saharicans, so dark-skinned Africans are coming to replace the Arab population of Tunisia. And this led to huge attacks against them and a state of kind of violence and terror of that community. Even, you know, black Tunisians are scared now. So this kind of shows the problems of the populist line. It creates violence, it creates state breakdown, it creates a societal breakdown.
And couldn't this be connected to the desperation of the masses? I mean, people must know very well that these problems existed before the influx of migrants or refugees.
You could argue that migrants are good for the economy, right? Human capital is the most valuable capital any country has. A lot of these sub-Saharan Africans are there as students who are paying fees to study at Tunisian universities, or who are there doing laboring work and so on. It's a deflection tactic. The labor market or the unemployment in Tunisia is very high, especially amongst the youth. And so instead of blaming yourself because you don't know how to do economic policy, it's easier to blame the minority group. You know, he's not the only political leader in the world who's doing that right now.
Yeah. Do you see this as his own unique brand of authoritarian leadership, or is Saeed paying attention to more competent, more experienced autocrats in the world? Is he actually modeling himself off of anybody?
I think it's a mixture. There are definitely autocrats that he models himself on. And if you can see his kind of his rise and his way of acting since he took power, you can see a modeling on President Abdelmajid Tebboune of Algeria right next to him, who kind of took power after a prolonged series of popular protests and then moved very cleverly to kind of break the back of this social movement. And I think that he's tried to do exactly the same thing by locking up, stopping the media firstly, cracking down on protests, cracking down on free speech, cracking down on political opposition. It's a parallel which a lot of people draw. And then I think the other half is that, you know, if he is good at something, it's being a populist. He's good at reading the public pulse. And, you know, his political philosophy and his political vision is the product of, you know, those old guys sitting in a coffee shop playing dominoes with each other, because this is what he was for most of his life. Yeah. And so he's always there to espouse a conspiracy theory or to espouse one of those crazy stories that these guys have.
Now, just before we end, I want to, you know, briefly bring the conversation to media now, something I'm sure has suffered from immense crackdowns and suppression. But is there any independent media left in Tunisia? I mean, who's getting the information out there?
I mean, one of the most prominent kind of radio stations, their CEO or their head was arrested during the crackdown in January of this year. And alongside that, you've had a lot of journalists who have been arrested for insulting the president, for want of a better term, which is not an actual law that you can charge people with. But when you're charging people through military courts, it doesn't really matter. And so because of that, there's been an atmosphere of fear created whereby he no longer has to kind of shut down radio stations or TV stations because nobody wants to talk anyway. And this is what kind of hurts the popular understanding of how bad the situation in the country is and how incompetent their authorities are. But also it affects the outside perception of Tunisia. So all those who work on the country or who are sitting in foreign ministries outside watching it say, well, you know, Said is quite popular. The situation is bad, but it's not that bad because there is no reporting on it. You can control the narrative. And really the only organization with access at this point is the state-owned media. And he's very particular about how they should act and what they should be reporting on. And, you know, even a big moment. So, you know, when he signed his memorandum of understanding with the prime ministers of Italy and the Netherlands and the EU commissioner, they had a press conference and there was no press allowed then. And I think that one moment sums up the kind of relationship between Said and the press. And even the Europeans were more than happy to play along with this.
Well, thank you for answering that, and thank you for bringing up the Europeans. I believe this is the perfect spot to pause before part two of this podcast. The next episode of this podcast will be entitled Tunisia on the Global Stage and Future Prospects. And this episode shifts the focus to the impact of President Said's governance on Tunisia's internal and external political relationships. It will explore international perspectives on Tunisia, reactions from regional neighbors, and the country's standing on the global stage. The episode will also discuss the future of Tunisia, the role of civil society, and the influence of technology in politics, concluding with some reflections on lessons learned from the Tunisian experience. So thank you very much, Tariq, and thank you to everyone for listening, and we'll see you all in episode 2.